everyone, and welcome back to the Faculty of Horror, podcasting from the digital and horrored halls of academia. I'm Alex West with
Andrea Subisati.
And we are back for the month of April. It is a new month. It is a very different month from the last time we spoke to you. And so we are recording this episode in a new way. We are on two separate campuses, so to speak. We are social distancing. And yeah, basically since the last episode on German Expressionism, Corona and COVID-19 has become a really big factor in all of our lives. And so we are always determined to bring you the show, and we're here. It's just going to be a little different for a little while.
Yeah, I hope it's okay to listen to. I don't know how much I like this.
I don't love not being able to, like, touch you, like, all the time that I do in recording. Like, I just want to, like, paw you. But I get to see your pretty face over Zoom. We're recording with voice memo apps. We're doing, you know, I think some kind of fancy stuff to hopefully make this sound as good as it can. We are thinking about all of you, our listeners. We hope you are doing well. We hope you're staying healthy and sane, if that's possible. And if you're an essential employee, thank you for everything that you're doing. And you guys fucking rock. And we all owe you huge after all of this. Speaking of debts to be paid.
Interesting segue. Look at you.
We may be in a pandemic, but I can still, you know, pivot a conversation. But today we are here to talk about a 1980 ghost horror classic, Peter Medak's The Changeling. This is such an interesting film. It has so much going on in it. It's so iconic. I think some of the imagery in this film is used all of the time in horror journalism and books and things like that. So even if you hadn't seen it before this episode, you're probably familiar with quite a bit of it.
Yeah, it's funny. We were texting a little bit in doing our research on this, and I knew I had seen The Changeling. I knew I had seen it long ago and many times. And then I was like, how do I not remember it? And then when I started it, my brain breaks this film into two pieces. And you were talking before about how it's kind of a hybrid of a haunted house and a ghost story. I feel like the juncture in between those kind of subgenres is, it's not jarring, but the film is kind of on the long side. And so my brain just kind of compartmentalizes it into two like that.
And it's funny because I had only seen this, I think, once before. Mm-hmm. And I remembered liking it, having some parts I liked more than others, but I remembered it being long. And then when I popped it on to watch, I was like, oh, it's only an hour 45. And by the end of it, I was like, whew, I felt every one of those minutes tick by. But I still enjoy quite a bit of this film. And there's so much in there to talk about. And I think through this conversation, we might hit on a couple of the things that maybe distance us a bit from this. Oh. But it's a very classic film in many ways. You know, very iconic, as I've already said, but also kind of important to the Canadian horror scene and Canadian film in general. So without further ado, let's get into it. This is 1980s The Changeling.
Within this old house live two residents. One of them is John Russell, composer, professor. The other has been dead for over 70 years.
Claire, I'd like to talk to you about the house.
Did you die in this house?
How did you die?
Whatever it is trying desperately to communicate.
What is it in that house, Claire? What is it doing? Why is it trying to reach me?
It's a hand.
Something of the senator's. He wants it back.
John?
Many films will frighten you, but only a few can really terrify you. The Changeling, an experience beyond total fear.
After the sudden death of his wife and daughter, composer John Russell moves to Seattle for a teaching job and settles into a large historic home for his time there. Soon, mysterious and unexplainable things begin to happen. John consults a medium and learns that a sickly boy named Joseph died in this house in 1906. John investigates and learns that Joseph was killed by his father, who feared his son would die before the age of 21, thereby nullifying the large inheritance he was due to receive and keep in the family. The father killed the real Joseph, swapped him with a healthy orphan who is now a prominent senator. John confronts the senator, and as the ghost of Joseph destroys the house, the senator has a heart attack and dies.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, that's The Changeling. This film kind of takes pains to investigate all these little other areas, like the creepy historical society, the lecture hall where John is teaching, and all the little ins and outs of a daughter who also died by a cart outside of the home. So it kind of takes all these really different little avenues.
I wanted to talk to you about Cora Carmichael and if she's like a red herring, or just to deepen the mystery in an element that maybe didn't satisfy.
I think it's a little bit of both of them. And I think the Cora and the kind of cart hitting her and eventually killing her is such a direct parallel to the way John's wife and daughter die at the very beginning of the film that there's that kind of pull in for John. But I guess I talk about ghosts and what they mean, especially in the 20th century, it'll kind of lead to the fact that, like, the difference between an almost inexplicable accident, a tragic accident, versus an act of malice.
Okay.
But I think it's also important to acknowledge how this film is, off the top, very Canadian, but also incredibly not Canadian. This was Canadian financed. It falls under the tax shelter films that we talked about in our Shivers episode. And this film, The Changeling, was kind of perceived to be the best example of what the tax shelter films could yield. It had name recognition stars. It was beautifully shot. It's a classy film. It's not like Prom Night, because God forbid anything ever be like Prom Night. P.S. Everything should be like Prom Night. But it had that kind of class that the Canadian film industry was really reaching for at that time. It was released in the States. It got, I would say, mixed reviews, but generally positive reviews. Even the Roger Ebert review, which I was reading earlier today, was kind of like, it's not great, but it's super fucking well made. And it won what was then called the Genie Awards, which are like the Canadian Oscars, and did well ish at the box office. So it was kind of perceived to be, you know, a turning point for the Canadian film industry, but it wasn't. It was, something that has become iconic over the years, but it didn't quite get enough steam to do anything else. And then in other ways, how it's not Canadian is it stars, American actors. It was directed by Peter Medic, who is originally Hungarian and was living in the UK. And it had a lot of other things that were happening. Like, the film is set in Seattle. However, it was shot in Vancouver. So it was always that thing of, like, Canada trying to be something else rather than embracing its Canadianness. It was trying to, like, Trojan horse into the box office as an American film.
Which is also very Canadian of it, isn't it?
Tis.
Now, being a Canadian film, Rumorg has some special love for it, obviously. And so one of the things I consulted for this episode was Rumorg 154, which is the April 2015 edition, where we celebrated 35 years of The Changeling. What I got from that was, I mean, I'm sure you also pulled up that Medic wasn't the first choice to direct, nor even the second. This project kind of floated around between a couple of directors. Now, he loved the script, but he made a lot of changes, and he insisted that everything be really realistic, which is a very interesting imperative for, you know, a ghost story, a supernatural tale. I think we're going to get into that more a little bit later. But I think what was most fascinating for me was, can you believe that they built that fucking house? It's a set.
No. I was shocked when I learned that.
Could not believe that. I was like, I would like to hear more about this house because it's stunning. And it almost looks like, it's almost Winchester-y in that it's like, mm-hmm. it has these corridors and like, insofar as obviously the room that Joseph was occupying was boarded off. I never really got my footing within that giant house, which is astonishing to me that it was a set and it still had that dizzying, labyrinthine perspective. So the house wasn't real, but the house that this house was based upon is real. It's based on the Henry Treat Rogers Mansion in Cheeseman Park, Colorado. And as the story goes, a playwright by the name of Russell Hunter lived there in the 1960s. And after experiencing supernatural phenomena, he found a journal detailing the life of a disabled boy who was kept in isolation. And a seance directed Hunter to another house where the boy's remains were found, along with a gold medallion identifying the body. So this was kind of pulled from reality, so to speak.
And it's interesting that this was released in a time when it wasn't as popular to say based on a true story or one of those kind of marketing terms that people often like to use. But it is. It's true. Actually, when I was doing some of the research, the amount they pulled from the actual event was pretty staggering. But the talk of the house and how important the house was to the story actually got me thinking about whether this film is a haunted house movie or a ghost story. Mm-hmm. And what are the differences? So I pulled out some research. I just used a couple of my basic books. I think I used a horror FAQ to kind of get at some stuff. But basically, the haunted house, as you would imagine, is so indebted to the location of the house. Especially in the 80s, they were really popular with films like Poltergeist. Mm-hmm. And Poltergeist is often a really interesting critique of a family who is desperate to kind of get into a house. And it's, oh, shit, it's a really nice house, but at what cost? Mm-hmm. You have something similar with the Amityville Horror. Mm. And so these films are actually often a kind of socioeconomic critique of many things. And I think this film, in a really kind of understated way, is actually a critique of class and a particular kind of class. Obviously, you have John, who's our protagonist, and he's seemingly this very well-off composer. He can move into this big house, even though it's kind of been abandoned for a bit, bring it back up to life, and he just can exist there. There's no worry or anxiety about him as one person filling this house. But it also speaks to the deaths that have happened in the house. The notion of a sickly child or a child who is disabled not being quote unquote worthy of inheriting or being allowed to try to survive until the age of 21. And the need to kind of keep this wealth within the family. And so this kind of notion of ownership over property, over wealth, I think that speaks to the Changeling kind of being a haunted house movie. However, on the other hand, a ghost story will have more to do with a variance in location. It's more about a kind of inner trauma, a personal trauma that is not letting people go. And often the task of a ghost story involves a previous wrong having to be righted. And I think what's really interesting is I think that's very much John's narrative throughout the film. He is not only dealing with personal tragedy, inner turmoil, but when he starts connecting with Joseph, or who he learns to be Joseph, he takes up the mantle of wanting to uncover this mystery of right this wrong. And I think that often has to do with John couldn't solve his wife and daughter's death. There's no fix to it. He can't, like, you know, it's not turning into a revenge film where he goes after the truck driver and the guy who's in the car. It's a very unfortunate accident. And so in uncovering this mystery of Joseph, in getting into the bones and the history of this house behind these locked, hidden doors, he is able to correct a past wrong. And I think that gives him the kind of purpose and a potentially a means for moving on in his life in some way. But it also kind of puts him in a bit of a trance. He's unable to do other things until it's solved. So for me, this film really deftly and interestingly plays with those notions of haunted house and a ghost story and brings them together.
Yeah. I agree with that. Although I'd like to ask you, do you consider Joseph's situation solved or rectified? Because I think one of the most compelling things that I pull out of this film is that there is no justice and there can be no justice when things are buried like that. Mm-hmm. There can be no resolution for Russell because that accident was just senseless and mm-hmm. he has to take it. And then, you know, there's his frustration with Joseph toward the end where he's like, I've done all I can do. And, you know, even when he blasts Senator Carmichael, I kind of felt this pang of pathos to be like, he's being portrayed as the villain, but really he's another victim, as far as I can tell. You know, when Russell exclaims that none of this is yours, like as if he's stolen it and he's devastated and we want to hate him because he's like, you know, an old white man, rich politician who tries to buy Russell off. And, you know, that doesn't seem to be virtuous. That doesn't seem to be in pursuit of the truth. But at the same time, like, it's not really fair. And it doesn't, to me, feel like reason or righteousness or peace is restored, especially the way the film ends. Like, you know, you've got the house in flames and then Russell and Claire just kind of outside. And that's that. We don't know if Joseph's spirit was to rest. We don't know if...
Well, you do have that moment with the music box.
Right, which implies to me that it's not.
Yeah, and I think Joseph, to me, is such an interesting character in this film and in film history at large because he is such a child. He is unable to kind of deal with things in the quote-unquote mature way that John is able to. John can't very well go up and be like, Senator, I'm on to you, and like shoot him in the fucking face. He's like, I'm on to you. I know what's happening. Here's everything I know, and I'm going to walk away right now and trust that you're going to do the right thing. And then, you know, when John gets back to the house, Joseph is like chasing his would-be girlfriend. Mm-hmm. He's like setting shit on fire. It's a child having a tantrum. It is a child who's so fucking fed up, and it just like, I'm going to burn it all to the ground. Mm-hmm. And I think that's so interesting because we often don't see that. Often children in film are portrayed as good and as pure and as like these things that save us. And here you have a child who's been so utterly forgotten and hidden away. And he was so close to having something happen to reify what he experienced. And then it all goes to shit. So then he just kind of winds up taking it. I guess he's galvanized and he takes everything into his own hands and, you know, kills his adopted changeling. He does away with himself in some way. And what I find actually quite ironic about the whole thing is, you know, the father who killed him is long since dead. Senator Carmichael is now dead. Mm-hmm. And Joseph has actually transcended through this anger, through this unrelenting wrongness of what happened to him. He's transcended and has actually had a much longer life and more effect than many other people.
Interesting. I mean, obviously, this film had a huge influence on much of cinema, but we'd be remiss not to mention Ringu, 1998. Mm-hmm. Another unwanted child left to rot in a well. Mm-hmm. But I feel like Ringu, it constructed a really cohesive lore in Sadako. Like, there's a similarity in that, oh, well, I dug up the bones and now you're free. Ha! And when that's not the case, it's really unsettling because it's a problem that can't really be solved. And, you know, whether Joseph has ascended, whether he continues to haunt, like, there's no peace to be had, I guess, is still my main takeaway. I like that.
Yeah, and I find the music box at the end that it kind of plays the melody that John has been kind of composing himself, and he learns that it's basically Joseph kind of influencing him. You know, Joseph, the original social media influencer. But it's the sense that it's not an angry thing. Not the music box popping open and kind of gently playing this music is not necessarily angry, but it's still there. It's still present. And for me, that kind of brings up something which I think all ghost stories struggle with at some point or another, which is the question of the afterlife. Where do you go for the afterlife? What happens? Is there an afterlife if you've got all these fucking ghosts walking around? And this film is very, I think, unreligious in many ways. There's not like a priest or anything to be fucking consulted at any point.
Yes, you're exactly right. And that's something that I really wanted to talk about. I'm glad you brought it up. Like, what struck me, I think what strikes everybody about this film is about how John Russell, how readily he gives himself over to this haunting. And we know that that's through his grief, but he's also kind of like, he assumes that the ghost needs his help and he's only too happy to do it. He's only too willing. He's only too able. It's the perfect storm that's perfect for him. And his grief is what afforded him that suspension of rational disbelief. But I think it's so interesting in that it's presented in a purely secular manner, like you said. There's virtually no religion at stake. We don't witness any funerary rites for Russell's wife or child. We can assume some kind of basic ground level, if you'll pardon the pun, Catholicism with the Carmichaels because they were buried and there is a baptism medal. But, you know, I talked a bit about Durkheim last episode and that he was the head of this structural functionalist school of thought, which assumes that anything that exists in society does so to fulfill some kind of social need. So whether it's high culture or low culture, everything from the Catholic Church to reality TV to Scientology to infomercials and everything in between, we might not be able to understand what people are getting out of it. We might not agree with what they're getting out of it, but it's happening. It's out there. If it exists, it's because someone needs it to in some way. And so here's a seance. And a seance is basically a secular mass in that it serves the same functions without Catholicism's specific set of dogma. So I started looking at seances and I found this chapter by Maxine Miska. It's called Aftermath of a Failed Seance, The Functions of Skepticism in a Traditional Society. And she opened her chapter with an anecdote and I thought it was so funny. Basically, an atheist is riding a bus and he says, God, if you really exist, make a rainbow appear in the sky right now. And suddenly a rainbow appeared and the atheist said, what a coincidence, a rainbow. And her point with that anecdote was that belief in the supernatural doesn't rely on the existence of the supernatural. Basically, our belief systems provide the foundation for the way we perceive these experiences. Like, it's predetermined. So in that way, whether you go into a seance expecting it to work or not work, you're going to be right either way. Either belief system, whether you're a skeptic or a believer, will have explanations as to what happened or didn't happen. You know, they work much the same way as like tarot cards and Ouija boards. Like, talking to the spirits is essentially talking to yourself.
Yeah, it's magical thinking, right? You're kind of putting some beliefs out there and hoping you see signs that kind of point you in those directions. I always kind of consider it agnostic over being atheist.
Right.
But I did love in the film when it's like, I mean, because this house is playing no games. Joseph is like banging on the fucking pipes. He's doing everything to get John's attention from right off the bat. And I love that John very quickly goes to like a hospital that has like a psychic research center. Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, right this way, Mr. Russell, mm-hmm. we've got the perfect person for you. Mm-hmm. And it's so matter of fact. And that's kind of actually what I've seen a bit of the criticism of this film is everyone is so matter of fact about everything. And I do see that criticism. I feel it a bit myself. I think what this film is trying to do is parallel that death of John's wife and daughter and the death of Cora and then the death of Joseph, these tragedies that surround us all the time. And then just kind of, they bring us together and they allow us to communicate in different ways. Mm-hmm. But I did very much appreciate, to your point, not anti-religious, but the lack of religion. It just felt actually very fresh.
I think my biggest problem with this film, and like, I didn't dislike it, but I don't love it. And I think my biggest beef with it as a horror film is that I don't get much peril. And perhaps it is in that matter of factness. Perhaps it is the way like it unfolds so rationally, or perhaps it's just because Joseph's tantrums are largely manifested through the house and they're just kind of, they're not really, I don't know, it doesn't seem all that personal. Obviously, there's a supernatural force at play that kind of lured Carmichael into this weird trancy suicide. But, you know, I never got the sense of, oh shit, is John gonna make it? Like, he's fine. Everyone's fine. Claire is way too scared of a wheelchair.
Yeah, the wheelchair was a little ridiculous. I feel like I kind of came to the changeling a bit too old, if that makes sense. Yeah. I feel like if I'd seen it like when I was a kid proper, it actually would have scared me a lot more. But I do think this film has a lot of discipline to it. I think it withholds a lot of stuff and a kind of expectation of the audience. Mm-hmm. If you're in it, you're going to jump into it. And I would rather see a film like this that kind of expects something of me and maybe doesn't achieve it for me because it is a kind of personal invitation to the film, mm-hmm. over something like, oh no, like a James Wan film, which I just feel so beaten over the head with like jump scares and like directional stuff that I'm a bit like, it's like I'm not even here. Mm-hmm. I might as well have just like left the room and you would have been scared in this room all by yourself.
That's right. It is a very elegant film. Like, the special effects are minimal, and where they're used, they're pretty effective. Like, I think there was reverse stop motion in getting the metal kind of excavated from the gravesite. And then when that cop got killed in the car, I loved the way that was done. I loved the way that was shot. That was cool as hell.
Yeah, I think this film, it's to your point, it's less special effects and it relies so much on the beauty of the set, of the look and feel, mm-hmm. of the house, and then of the camera work. Like, the camera's constantly constantly at odd angles. If you watch the film or you're rewatching the film, just notice the angles because they're constantly shifting and showing you very odd perspectives. And it's always the sense of John in particular being watched, that something is going on, whether it's, you know, that creepy lady from the Historical Society or Joseph himself. There's always something else and someone else in the room that I think gives it that kind of atmosphere that so many films strive for.
Yeah.
Will you tell us why you are not at rest?
My father!
Joseph, did you die in this house?
My room.
How did you die? How did you die?
How did you die? How did you die?
Father! Father!
So one of the things that struck me coming back to this film and rewatching it was the changeling, the notion of the changeling, because the changeling, can I say changeling anymore? No, I can't. Wait, I can. The changeling is a figure who I actually studied quite a bit in university, and it was a creature, a human-like creature, if you will, and it's found in folklore in Europe, kind of around the medieval period, and they exist a lot in the literature of the time, poems, fairy tales, folklore, all of that kind of stuff. And basically, the changeling is a fairy child who is left in the place of a human child. So essentially swapping it out overnight, usually. And often this figure is associated with disease or disability or something like that. So there is a prominent scholar who's kind of tackled this subject called D.L. Ashleman. And his whole thing was that changelings figured very heavily into pre-industrial Europe and families in Europe, particularly in the peasant class, because a child with a disability or developmental issues was seen as a drain on resources. So it was a way of kind of taking the onus off of the family, taking away that kind of stigma that could be attached of like, oh, that's not actually my kid. It's a changeling. It's something else. And each country in Europe practically had its own version of the changeling. So if this is something you're interested in, if you want to learn more about it, it's absolutely fascinating. But each kind of section of Europe has its own take on it. A couple I thought were very interesting was when it comes to trolls. Trolls believed it was better to be raised by humans. So often, troll parents who wanted to give their children a better life would swap it out.
Humans have it so good.
We got it great, guys. Don't worry about it. What's interesting about the troll thing, actually, is that trolls in folklore could not take unbaptized children. So that was another kind of Christian thing of like, get that child baptized and then it won't be a changeling. And then kind of across many folklores, some of these changelings either forget or don't know that they're actual fairies and kind of live a human life. Some remember or return to a kind of like fairy life afterwards.
It's like Harry Potter, right?
Completely, yeah. There was also like some folklore that's like the changeling was actually just a piece of wood. the fairy children were disabled children, but disabled fairy children themselves.
Okay.
And around this period, like medieval Europe, this is when the Christian church began to misinterpret any kind of disability as something to do with the demonic. So here you have this kind of really interesting, but incredibly problematic conflux of disability and demonizing disability. So we have a lot of different things at play in this, and it all feels very complicated. It all feels very weird. But again, this was kind of a way to pin the notion of being different as being something else. It's not actually part of our lineage. It's not actually part of us. It's something other. It's something shameful. And I actually have this book, which is really incredible. I haven't finished it yet, but it's really fucking interesting. And it's called Disfigured: On Fairy Tales, Disability, and Making Space by Amanda LeDuc. And we'll link this in the show notes. She talks a lot about her own experience as someone with a disability and how a lot of disabled stories become narratives centered around disability, and that the cultural good good is, you know, being beautiful, being able-bodied, and then the bad is, a kind of bad trait is to be disfigured or to have a disability or have a developmental issue. Now, this kind of need for a narrative comes from a required explanation for a disability. Why is this happening? Why do we need it? And, you know, we often tell stories just to make sense of them. So in having disability become a narrative, we are in some ways helping to expand our understanding of this, make it more human, make it more relatable. However, we're kind of now stuck into this pattern where we just kind of get, you know, stories about people with disabilities that are centered around their disabilities rather than having them in their lives and doing things and being part of the world that is much more normalizing. But to the point of the changeling, I think it's, you know, I was talking a bit earlier about Joseph, frankly, being a little shit sometimes. And fair enough, he was murdered. He was murdered for having a disability, which is bullshit. But often characters in these stories with disabilities, as LeDuc points out, have to have a lot of self-advocacy, as they often have to have in real life. So Joseph kind of like stacking everything, telling his story, making sure John finds out everything as he's supposed to find it, and then kind of throwing a bit of a tantrum at the end. It kind of lines up with this notion and this narrative of disability as having self-advocacy because no one else is going to fight for you. John was willing to walk up to the senator and being like, I know exactly what the fuck happened. You don't, but here's all the proof, and walk away. Mm-hmm. And nothing was going to happen. And then Joseph had to come in and be like, you know what? I'm going to light this goddamn house on fire. I'm going to astral project. I'm going to make things happen. And yeah, still in a fucking music box at the end, bitches. What? So to get back to LeDuc, she often points out, she didn't say any of the last stuff I said, but...
No.
Strangely, she didn't go there. But the notion of fairy tales, and this is what her book is about, and again, it's absolutely beautiful. It's fascinating. It's so well written. And the fairy tales pivot to transforming a character and their difference becoming an asset and something to be desired. And that's kind of where I got to my point of it's so interesting that Joseph and this figure is outlasting the lifespan of his father, his kind of adopted changeling. His disability has kind of caused a trauma that has allowed him to exist in some sense much longer than the people who are trying to cover it up. And I just thought it was super interesting. And I often on the rewatch, I remember the figure of the changeling being a child swapped out for a fairy child, but I couldn't quite remember how it fit in. And this notion of disability in the film is so fascinating. Mm-hmm. I think especially for the time in 1980, they handle it pretty well of, you know, calling it like, this is bullshit, this is wrong, and being confused and frustrated by it. But it adds something to this story that I don't think a lot of other horror films have.
Yeah, I agree. I also think this film, it came out in 1980. So it was kind of, you know, it was on the cusp. It was kind of a liminal time for horror where we were going from the more subdued, cerebral, elegant, beautiful horror movies like this to the slasher era. Mm-hmm. Pop culture got really bombastic in the 80s, but it was also a time where, you know, the family unit was undergoing change and also undergoing some anxiety. And I know we've talked about this on the podcast a lot. I think we talked about it with Nightmare on Elm Street, House of the Devil, when we talked about Satanic Panic. Like, this is a time where Reagan was like, you know, what about the children? The children, the children. But amid all that anxiety, you've got, you know, divorce rates are soaring. And people are kind of reconceptualizing what this nuclear family is. And so when we talk about changelings in the historical sense, the way you're talking about, the way changelings kind of complicate the notion of inheritance and legitimate heirs, that's something that's a lot more complicated now that you've got divorce and mm-hmm. remarriage is completely normalized. You look at the popularity of Game of Thrones, which is all about who has a valid claim to this throne. There's so many people who have valid claims to this throne. It's not as cut and dried as it once was. Once upon a time where it's like, Joseph is the heir and that is it. It's like, well, you know, Senator Carmichael kind of did all the senatoring. Maybe mm-hmm. he isn't the rightful heir, but he also put the work in. And I think anyone who's like, I had kind of a sort of stepson from a relationship for a couple of years. And any step parent who has heard, you're not my real mom. Like, you just get this peak of, I might not be your mom, but I have been your, you know what I mean? Like, that kind of authority has weakened mm-hmm. nowadays. And I think that authority was starting to weaken in the 80s, so it's a really interesting anxiety to tap into.
Hey, it's a car. Hold on, Senator. Wait a minute.
Senator, I'm John Russell. I'm living in your house. Senator, look.
talk. I want to talk. Let go of that. I want to talk. Let me go. Senator, look at this medal. It's a baptism medal. It's got your name on it.
You got it? You got it.
It was buried with a body. A little boy. Senator, police know about it.
Who's that? Some kind of crackpot?
I have no idea. No, never mind. Come on.
So another film that I wanted to bring up, Alex, and I love to talk to you about this film. Mm-hmm. Do you remember The Haunting of Julia?
Oh, yeah. I thought about that film while I was watching this.
Of course you did, because it is similar. And it came out in 1977. It, again, was kind of a British-Canadian collab. And it's a similar situation in that we've got this aggrieved mother who moves to this large house by herself to start over and finds it haunted by another murdered child. And she can't free herself because of her grief. How good is that film?
It's a great film. And I actually recently rewatched it. And for anyone, I think in America, it kind of goes under the name Full Circle.
Correct.
But it was interesting. I was rewatching it in prep for an event that has been subsequently canceled called Women with Guts in my lecture, because I was going to talk about it as part of the lecture, but to bring it into this conversation. And I think that lecture will happen just at another point in time, hopefully, with Salem Horror Fest, obviously. And I thought was so interesting about the two, as I had it in my mind comparing them, is there's so much narrative structure that they share. There's so much narrative DNA that they share.
Mm-hmm.
And again, for my purposes, for me, it was really interesting that everyone made such a big fucking deal about Mia Farrow's character inhabiting this big home. And like, how was she? Was she okay? Like, how are things in this big house all by yourself?
Mm-hmm.
And with John or George C. Scott in this film, it was like, you okay, bud? He's like, yeah, I'm all right. And they're like, great. High fives. Don't worry about it. Oh, this house is a little big. He's like, it's fine. Don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, cool. Big house.
That's right. And I don't want to spoil something as amazing as The Haunting of Julia, but the endings are quite different. It ends on a very different mm-hmm. note. And I think that's a very gendered difference. Perhaps someday we'll do an episode on it. I'd love to.
Yeah. Let's do it.
But it got me thinking about grief is a topic that horror explores time and again. Haunting of Julia is 1977. The Changeling's 1980. Obviously, I think we're seeing kind of a resurgence in interest in the topic with the new wave of quote-unquote elevated horror, starting with The Babadook, carrying through into Hereditary. In fact, I think there's a couple of movies that are kind of shoehorning that theme in. I'm thinking specifically of Antlers. I reviewed it for the magazine, and there's grief and there's trauma, and they touch upon it like it's taken for granted. Like, oh, well, you don't know what happened to me. And then these supernatural things happen. And it's like, no, we don't know. And we don't know how that plays into what it is that's happening to you. And you can't just drop words like trauma and expect us all, like, that's the only thing that gives these characters depth. And it kind of pisses me off. But now I'm getting on a tangent. I was doing some research on grief and the idea of grief as being a social emotion. And I came across an article called The Social Shaping of Emotion, The Case of Grief by Lynn H. Laughlin. And I will link to that, even though this article is largely, it's very speculative. It's very like, this is a thing that we should look at, and here's why we should look at it. But it really got me thinking. And she was talking about how one of the most illustrative ways that sociology can study things is by comparing different cultures and belief systems to determine what would be considered natural or innate to human beings and what behaviors are specific to environments. Nature versus nurture,
yeah.
Oldest time. And sure enough, there's evidence that people experience grief differently based on their culture. And I know we've talked in the podcast already about how within North American culture, we're fascinated by the subject of death, but we also keep it at a distance. You know, I think in the Phantasm episode, we talked about it a lot,
mm-hmm.
how North America is a death-denying society. We keep funerary rites private and protected and behind closed doors, but there's also a contradicting element of that in our society also loves the sight of suffering. And I'm not just talking about horror fans. I'm talking about reality TV. I'm talking about the news. So what we can glean from that is that we are happy to confront suffering from a safe distance, as long as it's not happening to us or someone we know, which is understandable. But even within a given culture, our attitudes towards death and grieving can change due to circumstance and over time. Like, you consider which deaths our society considers to be tragic and which ones are unfortunate but acceptable. And I feel like I'm seeing a lot of that touched on in the news today when we talk about countries having to prioritize who gets tested for COVID and who doesn't, who gets treatment and who doesn't. It's an ugly, ugly discussion that we always have to come back to. But at the end of the day, we always want to prioritize those who are nearest to us. And that proximity can be physical or it can be social and cultural. And we should also consider that we're living way longer than we did over a century ago. So many of our traditions assume that grief used to happen all the time, often starting at a really young age, and that affects our experience with grief. So anyway, getting back to that article, they gave grief a great definition, which is a response to involuntary loss through death of a human being who is viewed as significant by the responder. And so if we look at grief that way, then grief is fundamentally linked to the processes of attachment and those cultural roots. So I think when we're talking about John Russell's case, you mentioned before how his career and his stature in the community is really conspicuous. Like, we're seeing a very heteronormative nuclear family situation, and they seem very loving and affectionate and wholesome. And Russell, he occupies this unique position of he's a musician, but also an academic.
Yeah.
And I think if he were just an academic, he would be kind of ivory tower and untouchable. And if he were just a musician, we would picture a rock star who's like maybe kind of divorced from this sense of rationality, but he's in this liminal space of both worlds. And speaking of liminal space, I'm going to go back to religion for a second. Have you ever heard of unbundling?
No.
Well, you should, because you've done it.
Oh, is that what my uterus does every 28 days?
Maybe. But it's what we did about this time last year when you got hitched.
Oh.
So unbundling is a term that was coined by Harvard Divinity School. That's a thing. I was this many years old when I discovered that. Casper Ter Kuil and Angie Thomas. And it refers to the way people cherry pick elements of spiritual traditions. And it's become increasingly popular among the religious and the non-religious alike. So unbundling is having something like a ceremony that is traditionally religious, like a wedding, but kind of divorcing some of the Christian dogma from it.
Gotcha.
And these two researchers, they also looked at phenomena like CrossFit and Soul Cycle and how these things kind of function similarly to religions for their participants. And that just really tickled me because, do you remember back in the day when Facebook was new and you had really narrow parameters to make your bio and it was so important? It was like name, single, hitched, or it's complicated. And like, do you remember when there was just like so few buckets?
Mm-hmm.
I remember in the early days of Facebook putting that roller derby was my religion. And it really feels that way because, again, hearkening back to Durkheim, roller derby fulfilled spiritual and community and traditional needs that religion would have met. So obviously, Western society has become a lot more secular than it once was. And some religions can tone down the religious aspect to focus on the social and legal, like weddings, like your wedding. However, when it comes to funerary traditions, it becomes a lot trickier because much of how we understand death is rooted in spiritual takes on the afterlife. And I think you touched upon this earlier, like people reject religion to be freed of the dogma, which is completely understandable, mm-hmm. but science doesn't provide these comforting alternatives to the soul or the afterlife. And I think it's happening in friends of mine who have children and who are choosing to raise them in a non-religious way. And yet, you know, when Sparky dies, he's gone to doggy heaven, you know? Like, we don't really have comforting death vernacular outside of religious platitudes. Like, to this day, sorry for your loss is overused to the point that it's almost meaningless. And so many of us kind of defer to quasi-spiritualism that vaguely assumes the afterlife in some form. Like, they're always with you. They live on in our memories. They're always watching you.
Mm.
And so I think fundamentally what the changeling is about is this guy Russell, who he wants to believe in an afterlife. He's not religious, but he needs to believe that the people he's lost might find peace, whatever that means. And I think at the end of the day, that's what this film is trying to tell us.
Yeah, I feel like that's what I find interesting about the figures of John's daughter and Cora, is these were two tragic accidents that happened and they passed on. They're no longer here. They're no longer on our plane. They're in heaven or they're just gone, whatever you believe. They're not here anymore because their time was up. However, when there is something that is so wrong, so intrinsically wrong that happens to someone, they get to stick around for decades, centuries even, to see if those wrongs can be righted. And I feel like that's the kind of litmus test this film plays. It's about a kind of senseless tragedy versus a sensible tragedy. And I think that's so fascinating. And it is so fucking challenging because, you know, if someone I cared about got hit completely by accident by a car tomorrow and died, I'd be so fucking upset. But this shit happens. Like, shit just fucking happens sometimes. And it's so fucking awful, but it just does.
Yeah.
And you kind of have to live with this. However, if someone goes out and intentionally harms someone that you care about or does something that is so wrong, there is a kind of sense of justice that you can place on it because you have this moral boundary to it. And I think that dichotomy in The Changeling is so important to the film, but it's also very unspoken. And I think that's one of the things I like most about this film.
Unresolved.
Exactly. Yeah.
So here's my epic segue that yes, shit happens. And it so happens that shit is happening. Shit has hit the fan on a global scale that I can't even conceive of. And so if we're ready to move on from The Changeling, I think we should talk about what's coming up next for the Faculty of Horror. Because we're going to meet that shit head on.
Yeah.
We're going to get shit in our face. We're going to get it in our eyes. We're going to get pink eye. We're going to get it in our teeth.
Spoken like a true dog owner. And we did have other things planned. We had talked about other things, of course, obviously now. Salem Horror Fest, Women with Guts, has been postponed. Hopefully we'll get to do that weekend next year. But it kind of threw what Andrew and I were going to do for the rest of the year through the summer into a bit of tumult.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were talking amongst ourselves and we were like, okay, is this thing we want to do very insensitive or is it topical or blah, 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 blah. And we thought, okay, you know what? It's a bit of everything, but maybe it's what it needs now. So we are introducing to you, our listeners, Summer of Plague with the Faculty of Horror.
Dun, dun, dun! Copyright, trademark, no other podcast can do this.
No, I swear to God, if they fucking do it, you guys have to tell us and we will fucking sue them. But the thinking behind this was really, you know, we always say horror teaches us things. It does stuff to us. It gives us, it informs us. And we are in a time where we need comfort. We need direction. We need information. And even if that information is what not to do, we gotta grab onto it. So we thought we'd take the dog by the tail. We'd wag it and see what comes out. So Andrea, what are we doing next month?
Next month, we are going to do something cool. Take it away, Alex.
I love this part of the show. This part of the show is so fucking great. It's because I haven't had serial concussions. She's laughing. It's fine. We are going to do something we have talked about between us wanting to do for a while, and it just never quite got to the time where we could do it or felt right. But next month, we are going to do Rec 1 and Rec 2. We are going to do Spanish zombies, question mark, Spanish found footage. And we're going to talk about it all. We're going to focus on those two films because they connect so directly to each other. We will probably touch on the sequels. We will touch on the remake, the American remake called Quarantine.
Mm-hmm.
But fucking Wreck, I am excited to rewatch this. I tackled it a lot when I was working on my found footage stuff.
Yes.
Fuck, there's some great movies. I'm very excited to watch them again.
Cool, me too.
And then we've got a few other months coming up, obviously. I hope we do anyway. But we've got a couple other like plague, contagion-esque storylines and films we want to tackle. So please note, we are leaning into this. We're going to lean into it with all of the excitement and sensitivity and pathos that we have, and because this is the fucking time to talk about it.
And we really are in this together. I don't think there's ever been a social thing where, you know, like we often talk about, you know, we're a feminist podcast and there are people who don't like that, and there's an us versus them happening in politics that is valid and very, very difficult to stomach sometimes. But this is something that we are truly all in together. So I don't think there's much point in beating around the bush. I think we should talk about about it. I think we should be the community, the global community that we are, and, you know, just go for the jugular.
Yeah, let's fucking talk about it. It's not going to be a good time to talk about it. In a year from now, hopefully, we will have all moved on.
This is going to define our generation. This is going to define our lifetimes. We are deep enough in to acknowledge that, and so there's nothing to ignore.
Yeah. So yeah, that's your homework for next month. Hopefully you have time to do it. I just feel like I have so much extra time on my hands that I'm like, great, I'm going to watch all the fucking sequels now.
God, I do not at all feel that way. But that's okay.
But yeah, so check those out. Give them a watch. We're going to be back in May with that episode. So, of course, as we already mentioned, Women with Guts has been kind of canceled, postponed. Yeah. And so if you did get tickets to that, please contact Salem Horror Fest. I believe they're honoring those tickets for later dates and kind of credits to other festivals. Currently, October in Salem Horror Fest is still on.
For now.
But we will see where that lands. We'll keep you guys posted. Follow us on social media. As soon as we know anything, we post it. Obviously, follow Salem Horror Fest as well, so you'll keep up to date. But again, this is such a weird time. Andrea, do you have any final news bits to share?
I was just thinking about how I feel like I don't need to tell our listeners to stay home, and I don't need to tell our listeners to be vigilant and be smart and take care of one another, because our listeners are fucking with it, man. And I've seen an outpouring of support for people like us who are creating content, and support for people creating content during this time of trauma. You know, it's not easy to focus on something like horror movies when you're worried about where you're going to get your groceries or how you're going to pay your rent. But we are in this together. We're doing this for you, and we're going to get through this. I'm confident of that.
I am too. I've seen enough glimmers of hope that I think this is going to be okay. We just have to stay the course, be very British about it, keep calm, carry on, do what you can. Again, stay home as much as you can, take care of yourself, watch horror movies. I've caught up on so many horror films, and maybe we'll release some extra content where we talk about extra horror films we've watched. I'm putting Andrea on the spot for a reason. Again, if you are a frontline worker, if you're an emergency worker, thank you so much for what you're doing. We truly appreciate you. We are thinking about you and thanking you. If you can't in person, certainly emotionally and mentally. So yeah, you've got your homework. You've got your marching orders, which are to stay home and watch them. Mm-hmm. Take care of yourselves. Take care of the people you love. Call people you care about. Fuck. And until next time. Andrea? Andrea? Andrea, you stopped.
You froze, but like, we've done this so many times for so many years. I was like, oh, she's segueing. I could probably just blindly say office hours are closed and I'd be right. Would I have been right if I just blurted that?
Yeah.
I know you.
No.
So until whatever it is she fucking said that I missed because of lag, because of fucking social distancing, which is important and we love it, but fuck it in its face. Office hours are closed. 1,000s of ghosts in the daylight, walking through my hometown square. 1,000s of faces you touched on, 1,000s you lost in the fire. Knock, knock on the door of the house that he knew. The air grows cold round me and you, and it's cold. You know that he's there.
disappear. We'll walk till we get to the harbor. They'll never know we were here.